So I'm going to release this in front of the paywall. I'm going to just unlock it when it comes out, because I feel like this is the kind of show that like people should know what's behind the paywall. Like I save a lot of like, I kind of in my head, I call it kind of close reading stuff or kind of pop culture stuff or whatever. Mm-hmm. Some stuff that I just kind of squirs off the main focus of the show. Not that the show has a focus. Anyways, I'm sitting here talking about myself. Welcome, Sam. Welcome to the show. We've been planning this for a bit now, but we are here to introduce yourself. Tell us about your work and why we're here today.
Hey, nice to be on your show. I've been a long time fan, first time guest. So about myself, I run a media audio, basically podcast network, called Southpaw. We do some articles too, but, what is it about? I guess it started out just talking about martial arts and combat sports and MMA and boxing and stuff like that. But from a socialist perspective. So what does that mean? Doesn't mean that we always have to talk about Marx, but I guess it's sometimes about what it isn't. So just listening to some of us talk about MMA and combat sports, it probably means you're not going to hear like the bootstrap stuff, or like, you know, you're not going to hear things that are like ableist or racist or stuff like that. So not always about Marxist analysis, but it's always going to not have a lot of those like chud, you know, far right fascist kind of influence. And then from there, like, I had other interests besides just this. So started interviewing people talking about politics. And then from there, we started doing some other shows on top of that. And then I started writing some articles on top of that. So it kind of organically grew. But in an anti-capitalist way, I don't have any goals. So it's not like I started out with some kind of goal or have a goal in mind right now. It's just kind of like whatever. The way it's growing is the way it's going to go. I don't have any idea of where I want it to go other than like maybe I could do this full time. But other than that, it just goes where it goes. A lot of it is informed by like a lot of the people who join our Discord and, you know, have ideas or interests. And we just go from there.
Yeah, that's been a kind of experience of my show too. I'm lucky enough to have like a lot of people in my life who are academics, who are like easy talkers. You don't have to like, you know, you don't have to ask them. They don't need to prepare. They've done these like whatever 100 times. Mm-hmm. And usually they're like happy to do it because they're my friends and stuff. And one thing I've noticed is that they're like, oh, but my, you know, sometimes they're like, oh, but this doesn't really have to do with anything in your show. I was like, the only thing unique about my show is me. That's the only running theme through my show is that it's my show. Otherwise, like the world's a big place and there's like infinite amount of things to talk about. And also like even just pigeonholing yourself into like, this is my genre. You're just closing yourself off to like all these cool conversations that like you could have. So anyways, this is like podcast militancy hour apparently. But wait, so speaking of things that like are random things that show up on my podcast, I recently did an episode on the battle at Lake Changjin, which is like this huge action kind of war, Chinese war epic. And now we are here to do another piece of hot pop culture coming out of East Asia. What are we here to do? The sound's going to be already included in all of this, so everyone's going to know. And the title is going to be there. So why don't we just spoil the surprise, Sam? Why are we here?
We're here, apparently, to talk about Squid Game.
Yes. Okay, I have so many things to say. It was so good. It was so, so good. My ADD has reached new heights, and I can't even take most TV shows. So like, I watched a few TV shows and like a few I like movies because you can like pick them up and whatever, drop them off. Anyways, this is a big long preamble that it has no relevance except to say that this thing like just reeled me in. I've spent like the last 10 of the last 24 hours engrossed in the show, just like drinking it every like, telling all my friends, texting people, tweeting about it. This thing is so good. Mm-hmm. This thing is so good. I mean, it's like, I'm just going to say this. It's no accident that like, I mean, maybe it's just me, but like the last good movie, the really good movie I got excited for in a really long time was a Chinese movie. And the last TV show that I really have been like into is a Korean TV show. Like, America is in decline. I saw The Matrix, and I was like, America is in decline. When I saw the first Matrix, it was like everybody in the world wanted to get, even if it was bad, it was still dominant. But this is like objectively shit. Anyways, I'm like, I'm so off the wall here. Squid Game is so good. And you have written this article. And it's a great kind of introduction to it. It's kind of very straightforward. And you kind of, but you do kind of cover the like pretty intense reach of the show. So for the people who don't know it, who may have heard of it, like me, it's 48 hours ago, who were like, what is this show? Can you give us a rundown of what it is, the background, the fact that it's the most popular TV show ever on Netflix? I'm gonna stop gushing. I'm gonna mute myself.
So I think most people should know what this show is by now. I think even if you haven't seen it, the memes precede it. It's a Korean show made directly for Netflix. The director has and creator slash writer. So here's the other hard part about it is like one guy did the whole thing. That's part of the reason why for season two, he said he wants to have a team this time because it was so difficult to do it all on his own, be a one man, like writing, directing, creating team. So he made the show. It was his vision. He's had the idea for like 10 years.
111 million viewers have tuned in to watch Squid Game. What do you think it is about the show that viewers are loving so much?
먼저 너무 축하드리고요. 정말 엄청난 성공을 거두셨는데 세상에 1억 1,100만 명의 사람들이 이 쇼를 봤다는 게 믿겨지지가 않습니다. 어떤 것 때문에 그 성공을 했다고 생각하시나요?
1억 1,100만이 아니고 제가 4주 28일 동안에 1억 4,200만이 아마 200만 가구가 어카운트가 아마 최종 숫자일 겁니다. 그 4주 동안에. 글쎄요. 질문을 많이 받았는데 아마도 그 아주 단순하고 아주 너무 유치하기까지 한 어린 아이들의 놀이를 어른들이 그것도 목숨을 걸고 그리고 큰 돈을 위해서 한다는 그 컨셉이 주는 아이러니 그게 아마 많은 시청자들을 전 세계 모든 나라에 걸쳐서 다 관심을 가지게 만들었던 것 같고요. 또 아름다운 그 아기자기하고 아름다운 세트도 사람들의 눈을 사로잡은 것 같고 단순히 그냥 뭐 재미있고 즐겁기만 한 게 아니라 이 작품 다 보고 나면 끝에 생각해 볼 만한 우리 사회에 대한 어떤 질문과 메시지를 남겨주는 작품이기 때문에 또 다 보고 나서 항상 옆에 사람이나 가족들과 이 작품에 대해서 이야기할 거리가 많았어서 잘 되지 않았을까라는 생각을 해봅니다.
I'm going to have to correct you there because it's actually not 111 million. Last time we checked, it was 142 million households.
Oh my gosh.
So that's the updated number there. I think the reason that we were able to get so much attention globally is you take this very simple, almost very childish games that are played actually by children, and then the irony of really having those games being played by adults and putting their lives at risk and also for a huge cash prize. I think that irony really brought the attention of our global audiences, as well as, of course, the intricately built and very beautiful set as well. I think that we've created a series where it's not just entertaining, it's not just an entertaining show, but at the end of the day, you are left, after you watch the whole thing, you are left with this message, this question that we are really throwing at society, and that has led to create a lot of conversation, which is why I think it was so well received.
I don't think he expected the show to become so popular. It was a show about Korean debtors being sucked into this survival game to get out of debt and all the things they're willing to do to get out of debt. So it's a little bit different from like the way game shows and like money shows are portrayed, where you never see the contestants as somebody who's in debt. You see them as somebody who's at maybe zero or like, you know, some kind of positive number. And then the winnings from that game set them up to be a millionaire. It's like winning the lotto. You went from like zero to something. But that's not how it really is in real life, right? A lot of the people who want to do those things are actually in a negative number. They have a lot of debt. I think the same is true for the US. So oftentimes that debt, that money they gain is to just to bring them to zero. Or in this show, it's so much money, it's to pay off all their debt and then possibly get them some amount of quote-unquote freedom in this capitalist hellhole. So I think that is the general premise of the show, and they're playing children's games from Korea's past.
So the it's there's so much, man. There's so much in this. Like, once again, Sini is just floored. I am shooketh, as the internet people say. Like, the overlay of all this for me at the outset is that, like, okay, so here you have this kind of weird, perverse commentary on, like, not just like capitalist culture, but also specific sort of development of the last 20 years of pop culture, which is the kind of reality TV-ification mm-hmm. of everything, mm-hmm. right? Not just game shows and TV, but like everything turned into reality TV, right? Like, we had to go through a reality TV president, uh-huh. right? Like, that was, so like the fact that, and of course, like, if you push on reality TV a little bit, like, what it is, it's that it's the line between like fictional and like reality is like really blurred, right? Because there are these people who are in these contrived situations, just like a fiction, right? Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, Jane Eyre. Mm-hmm. Like, it's this contrived situation of these characters, of these individuals, you know, put together. But like, the fiction of it is written by the characters themselves, right? Like, the narrative of the shows. And of course, like, everybody knows all those fucking shows are fake, and like, they like edit it that way and they tell people what to do. Like, this is like well known.
I've been writing scripts for reality TV for 9 years.
I've worked on 15 different shows.
I've worked on 25 different reality TV series.
I've been writing episodes of reality television for 8 years now.
I've worked in reality TV for 12 years.
There's nothing real about reality TV.
It's as scripted as anything else you're gonna see on TV.
Before the first episode was even done shooting, we had already known who the winner was going to be.
This girl told us that she had been suicidal and now that she was on medication, but that she wasn't completely sure if it was working. Yeah, we cast her.
After the show aired on TV, I had shut down my Facebook account. People were attacking me, they found me, and I was afraid for my family.
Once they signed the release form, the show could do anything they wanted.
Most of the villains that I see on our shows are good people, and they're just completely misrepresented.
They can't say anything about it either, because if they try to talk to anybody, they can get sued. And that's why you don't even hear about this stuff.
From like the beginning, I think, from like the prototype of all these, which was like Big Brother, I think. Mm-hmm. I think like the UK and like in like real world and stuff, even anyways, like the way that, but then this was overlaid like reality TV with the traditional game show mm-hmm. of like people who want money, who are willing to go into this contrived situation of like, oh, let's do these activities for the benefit of viewers, mm-hmm. right? For the benefit and entertainment of viewers. Now, like, the macabre element of all this is that it's like, like in those TV shows and like whatever, like those wacky things, there's always like a safety net. But here it's not, right? Mm-hmm. So like the fictionality and the reality of it are kind of really blurred. Whereas like, no, these games are, you know, ostensibly real games, but they're like totally macabre and they involve like snipers and whatever. And yeah, it's like, it really is a really like incisive look into like the perverse joys we get mm-hmm. into watching like fellow like human beings do stupid things on TV for money.
Mm-hmm. You each have to lie in this coffin covered with worms and bugs. The three of you that can last the longest will move on to the next round.
I think what separates this show from previous, like the quote unquote genre of like survival games, is it felt so real. So like with Hunger Games or any of the previous other ones, it feels like it's a fantasy world or an alternate world, right? Or a dystopian future. Whereas this felt too real, right? Like, it could be happening now, but also the details that the director was putting in, like, I think unconsciously it struck a chord because it felt too real. Like, it didn't feel just like a fantasy, or it didn't even feel just like a critique, right? Whether people recognize that on a conscious level or not, I think that's what pulled people in. And whether the director recognized it or not, this is not fiction, right? A lot of people see Korea as like the good Korea, but like Korea, South Korea, had concentration camps. You know, it didn't work exactly one for one like this as far as like the game mechanics, quote unquote, but they had, you know, several major concentration camps throughout their history. And they did play deathly games. there were American VIPs backing a lot of this stuff. So it wasn't necessarily for entertainment, but they did have concentration camps. So I think a lot of those details comes from these things. Like even in the show, there's a line about how one of the characters didn't die, and there's this like golden rule where, you know, as bad as this world can be, we shouldn't like treat the marginalized different. There's a female character who says a line like that, right? As far as why she got to survive. Because South Korea, especially leading up to the 1988 Olympic Games, had this quote unquote social cleansing program where they were just literally rounding up unhoused people, orphans, you know, street vendors, people that they didn't think were fit for society, and they locked them up in these concentration camps, and a lot of them died, and the ones that didn't die didn't get some life-changing money. So, like, and the thing about this game was, Squid Game, this fictional Squid Game, is it started around that same time. So this wouldn't be hard to start, and it would be easy to hide because people were disappearing anyway, and it wouldn't be that hard of a sell to believe that if this were real, like the South Korean right-wing government at the time would have probably signed off on this because they had other programs that were very similar.
So like the premise, it's interesting the way that this show kind of like, even as like a forget the sort of powerful kind of like social readings and, you know, the kind of like social commentary obviously going on, and that's kind of cheap because social commentary sounds so like, oh, but like there's a very deep deep analysis of like late capitalism in Korea,
yeah,
and like what it does to individuals. And it's interesting the like even the scale of this, because like you mentioned the Hunger Games, which I didn't think about, but of course those began as these kind of these young adult novels, mm-hmm. right, that are kind of hemmed in by like the laws of novel kind of fiction. But this show is like a 10-hour serialized movie, mm-hmm. essentially, right? Like this is kind of like one of the aspects I loved about this and like other shows are common like this, is that like you can't really call this a movie. You can't really call it I guess it is a series, but like the line between like what Netflix has principally done, like, you know, to our kind of generic classifications is like, you know, do you watch something in one sitting, or do you have to spread it out over time? And you know, some people can do that with like 10 hours of sitting, but ultimately like what we, you know, like kind of serialization and stuff like that, it messes with our understanding of a show like Squid Game, because it's kind of just one story. It just unfolds over 10 hours. Like it's one really long, really amazing movie that has these multi-plot, these kind of like characters that are kind of woven together and like masterfully, I would say, mm-hmm. like they introduce it in this one main character at the beginning. And what's his name? I mean, the names are hard for me to say.
The Korean names.
Yeah, they're hard for me to say. So, Gi-hyun.
Yeah.
Gi-hyun is like the main character, and it begins with him, and instantly, like that first episode, like maybe we should sort of watch on spoilers, but like we could talk about the first episode, but like his kind of like, it begins with him being a kind of wretched loser. Mm-hmm. Like he lives with his mom, and like he, like, you know, kind of is abusive, and then he goes to the track, he like steals her money. Like it really is like setting him up to be, and he is a really sort of, you know, bad son. And then he wins some money, and the troubles sort of start for him there. This like very bad time, and that are kind of out of his control, but also his faults.
Mm-hmm.
That like, how did you get to this point that you are this way? That like you're so kind of, and that first episode, you feel such like pathos for him. Mm-hmm. Like, oh man, this guy's a pathetic character. Like, look at him, degenerate gambler, stealing his mom's money, his elderly mom who's working for him. But like, by the end of the series, you've learned so much of this guy. Like 10 hours of like content later, you've learned so much about this guy, and you're so moved by his actions, his like, you know, his development, like all the great elements of like a novel, of like a realist novel, are unfolding in a good Netflix series, like the way they are in like a big novel, except it's, you know, a 10-hour, very expensive, you know, like complicated like movie set, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But like, just that main character alone, like Gi-hyun, is such an interesting, the way they develop it, and like the specific things you learn about him, like the strike. You learn that he used to be part of an auto group. He used to work in an auto manufacturing plant. He was fired, and he recalls the story of how they protested. This becomes kind of like historical fiction of South Korea. Like this whole show kind of narrates the kind of, I mean, it's not that deep, I would say. Would you say that? Like the actual, like, historical elements of it are not profound. Like, it's not like, it doesn't try to be, which is actually a compliment, I think. Like, it doesn't try to be so historical. Like, ultimately, it's like this contrived plot about this, like, really sick situation. But the characters in, like, kind of revealing the characters' backstories, mm-hmm. you learn about Korean history through these individuals, which is like a tactic of historical fiction.
Mm-hmm. I think it spent a lot more time, like if it was like a video game, like a spreadsheet where you divvy up points in a character, right? I think they put most of their character points into like the conditions, like in the storytelling. These are the conditions that create these stories less. And it put most of the points there rather than, to your point, right? Putting it into these deeper points, right? It's like these are the things that are happening, and this is what is setting off these events. This guy is in debt. This guy had a protest. It's more like very much like bullet points, and this is what sets up the situation. So I think very much like a historical fiction in that way.
And like there is a little bit of the story of the Civil War, but not really. Like just the one character is from the North.
Mm-hmm.
And her name, what was her name? Oh man. Again, bad with names. I have the Wikipedia page open.
I think it was Sebyeok.
Yes. And she was, her story is amazing too. And like that development, she begins like so like, I don't know, man. I have like no words. I'm like totally fucking fanboying out here with this show.
Yeah. No, it's a good show. I think you're a late adopter, right? A lot of people were feeling this like several months ago.
Yeah. I'm very late to the game, the global phenomenon. People are like, wow. I'm like, wow, what is this thing? It's great. This is what you people have been into. But like another thing that I like did want to bring up with you is that like, so in your article, the general kind of circulation of South Korea is in kind of contradistinction to the North, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that like, as you said, like this is the good Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And like what that means in practice though, is that like in reality, like Southern Korea is like occupied by American soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like one of the key sites of their like occupation of East Asia, like along with Japan, Okinawa Island, like, this is part of like an occupation that began in World War II and has not ended.
Mm-hmm.
And with that occupation has come like a series of governments. I mean, I did a recent episode on Korean history, and like, if you really want to talk about like authoritarian politics, the idea that like North Korea is some kind of like crazy exceptional place, it's like, no, like authoritarianism is like this label that's like loosely applied. Mm-hmm. Obviously it's only applied to our enemies.
Yeah.
But like, Syngman Rhee was a legit dictator.
Mm-hmm.
Legit dictator, like way more than like Hafez al-Assad supposedly is in our brains.
Yeah. And he wasn't even from Korea. I mean, he was born there, but he was a Korean American that they brought in to rule over the whole peninsula.
Yeah. Yeah. He was like their chosen guy. For my show, I went through this footage of like, oh yeah, Syngman Rhee's fourth election. Everybody's, and it's just like, who are you fooling?
Did you see the first lady?
No.
So Korea's first lady that Koreans never bring up, and even the right wingers don't bring up, is a white woman from Austria, which was his.
Oh my God.
So because of the US involvement, the first Korean first lady is a white woman from Austria.
Oh my God. But like part of the show though, is that like you learn the main character, Ji-hyun, is like the main vehicle for this. Mm-hmm. He's kind of like the everyman that you put in through him and through his experiences. You like principally, like you spend most of the time in his life, especially that early first episode, like you spend the most deep amount of the time with him and his, let's say, recruitment into this crazy game. And throughout the call, it's called game, right? They use the English word.
Yeah.
What's the deal with that? Is that no word in game for in Korean? There must be.
No, nori. Yeah. And if you listen to the characters, they call it squid. They often use the word nori. But
oh, okay.
But it's just understood that it's the game. It's kind of like a difference in how the two languages work. So like if we did an actual translation, the game that they finally play wouldn't be called Squid Game. They would just call it Squid.
Right.
So that's how I refer to it in the, but I think it would be, that's how I refer to it in the article, but I think that's confusing for viewers and people to write about. So they have to say it's Squid Game, not Squid the animal, right?
Here, pause for a second. My I got to close the door. There's my dog. You can hear her, I'm sure. Sorry about that.
No worries.
But okay, here we go. So right. So game part, you learn, it's interesting, even his recruitment to that game. Can you tell us about that kind of Korean Pog looking game that kind of lures him into it at the beginning?
Yeah, Dakji. So yeah, it's like, and I haven't even looked this up, but like the history of Pog, I wonder if that goes back to Asia anyway. But
I think so. Isn't it Hawaiian or something? Maybe I'm making that up.
Okay. But it's this folded tile game. And the reason why it was popular in Korea, because post-war, like, you needed games that you could play with no money and there was paper around, so you just fold it up and you use the papers to create like a thicker tile and then you use it to slap each other's tiles and then you win that way, right? So this is the game, but the show added an extra game element about these two colors, red and blue, and gives Gyun the option of which color do you want to play with, and then uses that to gain Gi-hun's trust to lure him into the actual bigger Squid Game.
That first episode too is so interesting. It's so powerful. Actually, except I don't remember now. It's all a blur.
Mm-hmm.
But like, is the first episode? No, when's the first game? The first game is in the second episode, I think. I'm not sure.
Well, people consider the Dakji as like the first unofficial game. They call it sometimes in articles like Game Zero, right? Because it's not actually one of the official games. The first official game would be the one with the doll, which some people translate to red light, green light. But in the show, they call it Mugunghwa, which is what Koreans call it.
Right. So it is in that first episode. And it's like the violence of the show is so shocking because of the contradiction, like the sort of the weird contradiction between like the childish play but like the very real consequences of losing, mm-hmm. which is getting shot in the face.
Yeah.
Basically, like it's so like intense. Like all of a sudden the violence show up. You know, I never watched Battle Royale.
Mm-hmm.
Are there shades of this in this or no? Because Battle Royale was really influential.
The director said, because people bring that up, but I think for a lot of Westerners, like that, as far as like Asian death game movies that they've seen, that's the one that they could think of.
Yeah,
and it was
true.
A big hit back in the day, but it's more like this Japanese manga called Kaiji. And even the director said he was very much a big fan of Kaiji. So if you've read Kaiji before, then you could see a lot of elements of that. So it's much more Kaiji, which is actually a game about a gambler. It's called actually Kaiji, I believe, The Ultimate Survivor, which if you already knew that and then you watch this, then you could see why Ki-hoon is the main character, because everybody kind of, especially if you haven't read that comic or just don't really read into the character too much or the things he says, you see him as this lovable loser, like the Bad News Bears, right? And you see Cho Sang-woo as like the bad guy, but he's actually, in my opinion, the main character and the one to survive because he is the ultimate survivor, just like Kaiji was, meaning out of all the characters in the show, he's the only one who never thinks about giving up and never thinks about killing himself, right? Even this quote unquote, like, bad guy who's willing to do anything to win, Cho Sang-woo, which is how people read him. Spoiler alert, right? He very early on is about to commit suicide with using carbon monoxide poisoning. I think a lot of people didn't catch that. And then in the end, he does kill himself, right? Whereas that's something that the main character, Hyun, would never think about doing. In the first scene where you see them as children, he even says in there that winning Squid Game is his favorite memory because it's when he felt the most in control or the most powerful, because he's willing to do whatever it takes to win, which is in the game as children. He's playing with a young Cho Sang-woo, and he lies to him. He says, your mom's calling, right? And Sang-woo's willing, he's trying to play an honest game, so he falls for it. And then when he grabs his shirt, Hyun is willing to just, even though he's poor, he's willing to rip his shirt in half to win. And then it goes right to the narration about, like, this is why it's his favorite game, because he's the best at it. And he's the best at it because he's willing to do whatever it takes to win, right? That's very much like the character, Kaiji, as well. So for you to be the ultimate gambler, to win every gambling game in that manga, you have to be willing to do whatever it takes. And that's Gi-hun. He is the ultimate survivor. He will do whatever it takes. You go back to that scene where he's like, gratuitously licking, which I sometimes call boot licking, right? He's willing to do that.
That was so good,
right?
That
he's willing to do
so
whatever,
good.
Right? Whereas the other guy, right, yeah, afterwards, is like willing to fight the guards to survive, right? So it's this like juxtaposition. So I think people are reading him to be much more heroic and good than the director intended.
Like, the whole sort of arc of the series is very kind of interesting. Is that like most of the show, most of the series isn't the game parts, right? Like, they're still involved in the game, but like, it's the things that happen around the game that are actually the more interesting. Like, I think, I don't know, that's too simplistic way of thinking of it, but like, the commentary on like the violently classed nature of Korean society under capitalism, late capitalism, is also so active because the guys are from the same neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Like the two main characters, right? Like Gi-hyun and what's his name? Sang-woo, yeah. He is there. These guys are from the same neighborhood, and their mothers know each other. But they're like kind of sliding doors inversion of each other's lives. Like, one was hardworking and went to school and followed a respectable middle class life and did what you're supposed to do under capitalism, at least to a point, as you learn. And the other guy is kind of, at least from the beginning, you think he's this loser. He doesn't work hard. He's a gambler. He's a deadbeat dad. So like, there is that traditional thing that's very palpable in a lot of like fiction, which is the middle class guy is virtuous and the working class person is like some kind of scoundrel. And it's his fault that he didn't, you know, got that way.
Yeah.
And yet here they are, both of them in a bad position. Both of them equally in debt, both are not even equally. One has way more debt.
Yeah.
The middle class guy has way more debt than the working class guy. So like they both are products of the same violent capitalist system.
Yeah.
They ended up in the same place, even though they had two very different beginnings, you know? And it's so like I mean, I guess we are spoiling it. Sorry, folks.
Just assume we're going to spoil the whole show. Right?
It's been three months. So, but like the way that they're like kind of the whole show is bookended by their battling in this game.
Mm-hmm.
Like I thought at first I was like, it's kind of corny. How what would be the odds in a country as big as Korea that two guys from the same neighborhood are picked? But who knows? Maybe this was on purpose. Like, it turns out that some crazy billionaire was like at the heart of all this. But which was like itself a weird, I don't know. I don't know how I felt about that. That was like at one point I was like, that's too easy.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess there has to be a show like this needs to have twists.
Mm-hmm.
And like, how many twists can you have in a show like this? That's like where it's so violent and people die all the time. Like, you can only do so many things. So that last thing with him being the guy who's like the source of all of this, like the wizard,
He's
like the old man behind this. I mean, those scenes where he kills him, oh boy, or doesn't kill him, the marble game.
Yeah.
Oh man, that was like, and the woman from North Korea versus with her partner, what was her name?
I believe it's Jiyoung.
Oh, man.
With no last name, and it's a very generic Korean name.
Like Oliver Twist.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It was so like, oh, it was such like.
Let me ask you a question, and you're the academic here, right? And so you're drawing parallels about why we read into this and about like the middle class or the upper middle class, the person who's moved up. And we then instead, you know, relate to the working class person in Gyun, right? So that's like the obvious superficial reading of this. But throughout the show, you see Sang-woo, he is the corporate finance guy. He is like the least like enamored with capitalism. He's like the biggest like doubter of capitalism because he did everything you're supposed to do. And when he got there, he realized there is no escape. There's just going to be more debt. I'm never going to be one of them, right? And throughout the show, like Gi-hun keeps nagging at him, but you made it. You did everything. Like he completely, Gi-hun is the believer in the American dream, right? So my question for you is, do you think that has parallels also where like sometimes maybe this is why certain academics like turn Marxist or socialist, right? They see that the promised land is a sham, right? And then, you know, do you think there is some parallel where a lot of the working class kind of really buy into this because they never actually gotten to all the steps and saw that it was all a sham? So to them, it's still like behind a curtain, it's a mystery. So maybe they believe in it more than some people who've gotten to the other side and realize it's all a sham.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like it's no, like we live in a society ruled by like the bourgeoisie and it's actually ruled by oligarchs, but ultimately like the political order or like the economic order rests upon like this class of people who are not the biggest class of people in society, right? Like not by any stretch, but their interests and their concerns and their, you know, values and stuff, like sending your kid to university is a bourgeois middle class value, right? Like that's like straight up. I mean, in America, it's complicated because by the fact that so many private colleges hooked on to this and they manipulated people into going deep into debt by saying that, look, you'll make up the class gap if you take out a $80,000 loan and to go to like a third rate institution that like, you know, is private and it's just kind of like running on, you know, alienated cheap labor. It's still ultimately like bourgeois values. Something
well,
Gi-hun
even asked him, right? At one point, like, you went to a really good university. How can you be poor? I don't understand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is like, tells you like, oh, do you understand how university works?
Yeah.
And so like, and that's the thing, like the class kind of, the kind of upstairs downstairs story between them plays out underneath the whole show subtly, and it's there. And that it also kind of happens with the women a little bit, not really actually, because both of them are kind of proletarian, I guess you would say. Because like, actually, it's not true. The daughter, the woman with no last name, has her father was a pastor, right? And it turns out he was like abusing her sexually, like he ends up murdering his mom. And so like the darkness of the show and everybody's biographies and like the violence of capitalism really makes itself evident in people sort of getting to know each other in these isolated individuals who just kind of flow outwards. But yeah, to go back to your question, I totally agree that like there is a very real and it's very active project that happens in all kinds of cultural spheres, whereby university education or college education is highly vaunted, even though, you know, it's a huge source of debt. It's like one of the first ways that they really get you into debt, which is actually why they want you to do it. Like, it's not to like make you more worldly. Like, I taught at college, like a good college too. Like, and I taught at like a private college too. I taught at public schools. It's just money. It's just a big corporation. And they like, it's a huge factory, like a, you know, factory for people to put in and like where they give money and they get to attend and they come out with this piece of paper and, you know, some kind of, you know, cachet. I guess they do hold you hostage on paper in the hiring market by saying that, oh, minimum degree requirements. And that's the way the system works, right? And like, that's the way kind of system reinforces itself. But ultimately, yeah, it's this violently class ideology of like, oh, I must send my kid to school and whatever. And, you know, in the US, that's like a big honeypot for getting people into debt. But yeah, God, we didn't even talk about the Pakistani guy. Ali.
Yeah.
Is this a thing in Korean culture? Is this a thing in Korean sort of pop culture that like the kind of he wasn't tokenized in any way, but like he felt as real as everybody else. His Korean was fine. But there was no ideological project of like, I want to be Korean. He was just trying to survive, which was an interesting thing for me that like so much of like what gets represented as like, you know, immigrant identity or like immigrant struggles in a world, big world, is a way of people assimilating to the dream of becoming a hyphenated American, right? Or marrying someone and then having kids who are blankety blank Americans, whatever, right? Like that's something that is something valuable, but it wasn't here in this, obviously. Like Ali is not trying to be Korean. Mm-hmm. He was just trying to make a life for himself in Korea.
Yeah.
And you meet his family and his kids briefly. The whole thing with him getting his wages from his corrupt boss, like, oh man, that was so good.
Did you know that South Korea has the same Independence Day as Pakistan? Actually, I think Pakistan is 2 days, so I think one of the days overlaps, right? August 15th. I think Pakistan goes from like August 14th to August 15th.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it's like these people, you had Korea from Japan and then U.S. occupation, you know, and this is like the aftermath of it. And then you have this other person coming to Korea because the situation that the British left them in, it was so bad that he had to come to Korea, right? I think, you know, that is a reading that people should do, whether the director, because the director doesn't just own it. He pulls from his own environment and this is what he's seeing, and he created this fictional story. But like, where is this coming from, right? A lot of fiction is informed by reality and real history. So I think it also makes just another indictment about colonization, about the West, about like this occupation, that the things that happened before the events in Squid Game that sets off Squid Game, you know?
Yeah, like it's part of what gets like interesting over the course of the game is that like the ethics of the game, the people who are administering the game, is that there is this kind of ethical thing that they insist on, which is everybody is equal here.
Mm-hmm.
The rules of the outside world where people are unfairly like pitted against each other through money, that like money in that space, because they were all, I don't know, it's crazy. They're like the kind of Marxist, my Marxist brain is kind of blowing up right now, because this is the most purified, the game show like this. I mean, not like this, obviously, but like the game show set or like stage is like one of the most hyper commodified scenarios where the entire goal of the scenario is money, right? The character, the people on the game show want to make money, and the host wants to make money, and the TV show producers want to make money. And like something that like always thought it was funny to me that like in a capitalist country, under capitalism, we don't make culture, say, for culture's sake. Obviously, we make it for money. And what that means, though, is that like television, at least the old model of it, was you spend a lot of money, or not much money, depends, in the hopes of keeping people enthralled for like a portion of time, and then you keep them as you sell them things, like in that in-between space. So I always thought it was funny. I was like, oh, so the whole point of a show is to sell things that they show you when the show isn't on. Like I always thought the idea of commercials was funny, and like, you know, like we couldn't just produce shows for their own sakes, which is what Netflix has ended up doing, right? Like,
yeah.
Netflix has ended up sort of just giving us culture for free with no commercials in between. Now, that's also commodification, but like this series is about like the most commodified scenario in our ultra commodified society.
Yeah.
You know, whereby all the elements, all the class and historical elements, gender, are extracted. I mean, I guess there are still gender imbalances in that, whereas some games are devised and men have an advantage over women, obviously. Like if they had divided, say, like the tug of war teams into men and women, mm-hmm. that would have been structurally a way of getting the men to win, because the men are bigger and they would have beat them. But because the people had to like make teams and stuff and like form their own social organization, it ends up accidentally becoming fair, in the sense that what we think of fair is actually the free market.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like it's actually, this is just market. So like that's what they aspire to in this space, is that the market rules. Like, the market is the purest thing, and that's what rules. There isn't this extra stuff, ideology or whatever, like, oh, the doctor gets special access because, I mean, can we talk about the organ thing? You were going to say something.
I was going to say, maybe because you hadn't seen it yet, you know, you're purposely avoiding a lot of like Squid Game stuff, but like there were a bunch of business articles and motivational articles that came out about this. Like, Squid Game was like this ideal, you know how whenever there's things failing in capitalism, capitalists will be like, that's crony capitalism. That isn't real capitalism. Real capitalism has principles, right? So Squid Game is this like principled version of capitalism the way it's supposed to be. And a lot of people were writing these articles about lessons you can learn from Squid Game about individualism and like believing in yourself, right? And so...
Did you enjoy Squid Game? Me too. What a great show. And Squid Game taught us loads about leadership. So let's explore five of the leadership lessons that Squid Game can teach us. I'm the boss does not work. Through the whole Squid Game, we see examples of how authority, when forced, leads to mistrust and betrayal, even though it may seem on the surface that all is well and things are working just fine. We see this a couple of times with Player 101, Jang Duk-soo, betrayed in the outside world by his soldier when his troubles catch up with him. And then also during the marbles game, when his supposed ally, player 278, shows his true colours when the pressure is on. Do you think that just because I call you boss means I'm your lackey? That was a key comment. Leading a team by throwing your authority around might get you some short-term results, as it did with this character. And I've seen a number of corporate leaders make great strides in their own careers by displaying their authoritarian side to get results. But ultimately, this kind of I'm the boss approach just doesn't cultivate genuine followers. And when it all hits the fan, you'll find that those so-called followers won't be sticking around very long. And they might even stick the knife in.
That's so funny. I knew that there were like people who were sticking their foot in their mouths who were being like, oh my God, this is North Korea.
Yeah.
You know, like, and like, I remember that happening and I remember people getting really excited, but I somehow missed those articles. I'm not surprised, but like, it really is one of the amazing things too, is that the whole series of the show isn't just about the games, right? Like, it would have been really easy to like really go ham on the games themselves, especially considering how bloody and violent they are. Mm-hmm. Like, the spectacle of the games is really intense, and like, really, I think that maybe the bridge game is pretty intense too, I feel. But like the first sniper game and the bridge game were like, for me, the most intense.
Mm-hmm.
And like the game with like the sugar tree and stuff was like kind of dumb and whatever. I mean, even though ultimately like the series was about like the politics surround, like the human dramas that develop around this sick and twisted game.
Yeah.
So like, what was amazing when they were building barricades to like protect each other.
Yeah.
And like, that was one of my favorite moments of the whole series, where like Gi-hyun is like suddenly showing up and like his experiences. And it turns out that he was like a strike leader or part of a strike at least.
Mm-hmm.
And like participated in this militancy and got attacked by cops and this back. And suddenly the depth of his character in a real way gets like brought out, and not in like a cheap way of just like, you know, the way that it's always done in like shows like this, that it's like, let me tell you about myself, man. And then it's like flashback and like whatever, like corny, whatever. But like, this was like so elegant. Again, I'm gushing about the show. I can't stop.
I think because even without making it a point, or just culturally, it makes more sense in Korean stuff to be like an ensemble, to be a team. Like if you saw a situation like that and it wasn't a remake. If that was the premise, I could see an American version of this where it was much more about like individualism and like everybody against each other, right? Which Squid Game ultimately is also, but there's much more elements of like, as soon as they get in there, people are like, let's pair up, let's team up, because I think that is much more of like an obvious thing for people in the East, right? I don't want to like do a pan-East thing, but I think, you know, non-Occidental, people outside of the West, I think it is much more an obvious decision to not, especially in a dire situation, to not think of yourself as an individual, but to like gain strength with others, right? So I think that is just something where it wasn't even trying to be a message, but that is just something like one does. Like if you're a Korean writing that's what the characters would obviously do. And I think because of that, that also struck a chord with certain Westerners that like related to that. They're like, oh yeah, 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 yeah. Like much more that than those games where it's like everybody out for themselves right from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, well, part of the sort of premise of the game, though, is that, like, to survive, you do have to make allies. Mm-hmm. So that you do have to, like, occupy, you do have to sort of, like, find a way to protect yourself from this. And it becomes, very quickly, it goes from this, like, survive that first game as an individual, and all of a sudden they see the stakes. They see that, like, oh my God, if we lose this game, we're going to get shot and murdered. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, like, that's just, like, this is not some childish thing. And so, like, instantly that social kick of, like the way that this is also, like, a summer camp movie. Like, it's like a people, like, that's the thing. Like, kids are, all these diverse characters are brought to this place.
Yeah.
And they all live there and they all eat there and they're all just kind of making their way. And all the drama that unfolds inside of that is then the excuse to learn to dive more into, like, each character and their stories, which is, like, kind of like summer camp movies. Like, you mm-hmm. learn about these characters, they all, like, what brings them together, and then in bringing them together, you explore their individual selves,
yeah.
and, like, the individual histories. But because it's sandwiched between, or, like, these, like, sort of, not tender, but kind of characterization things, or moments of characterization, or kind of depth deepening a character, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
are then sandwiched between these deeply violent, childish games mm-hmm. that are, like, you know, very traumatizing to watch. Like, that first game where they're getting sniped.
Yeah.
Like, you are shocked. You are legit shocked. Cause, like, that girl, what's funny too is that I'm on TikTok, and there were a bunch of memes I wasn't getting. It turns out they were all from this.
Yeah.
And they were all from the dubbed version, it turns out. Well, some were from the dubbed, and, like, they kept the music and stuff, but, like, the red light, green light thing.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's, like, a TikTok meme. So it's like, has there been any sort of writing on, like, the difference between watching it in Korean and watching it dubbed? Because I accidentally watched, like, 10 minutes of the dubbed thing,
uh-huh.
thinking that I was like, oh, is this the only option I have? Not realizing I have to press the select button. Again, 20 years, Netflix has been around. I don't know how to use it for, like, 15 years. But, like, I didn't think of, like, oh, I got it. It was so much better with the Korean. But
yeah.
I bet a ton of people are watching it in English.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did watch it in English. So depending on how they watched it, if they watched it in English, or they watched it with dub on, or they watched it with the closed captioning dub on, they had, like, three different experiences. Because I just watched it, you know, I spoke Korean, and I always have subtitles on, because I don't know, because a lot of times the sound on a show isn't mastered correctly, so sometimes the music is louder than the dialogue, or characters are talking fast or mumbling. So I just got into a habit of always having the subtitles on, even for English shows, just English speaking shows, just so I could catch everything they're saying, right? So when this show came on, it also automatically had it on. But from what I understand, yeah, the dub is very bad. The closed captioning dub is also very bad. And then, like, they're just the regular subtitles are okay. And so because of that, then people got different readings of it.
This is not the only sort of, like, global, this kind of, or, like, a piece of sort of Korean pop culture fiction to, like, make it, and which is based on heavy class critique, mm-hmm. like a violent critique of class politics, because there's Parasite too. Parasite mm-hmm. was a huge hit. So, like, is there something going on in Korea? What's been happening that all this kind of, that a lot of this, I mean, I know that, like, the rise of K-pop was partially aided by the government.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like, is it just me, or are we going through a kind of Korean moment right now?
I don't know. I don't know how you would gauge that, but I think because Korea doesn't have that studio system yet, you know, I think they're creating a lot more interesting stuff. I think it's much more common to do class critique in Korean stuff, even just like a soap opera. They always do, you know, talk about debt and just talk about, like, rich people being the enemies. That's not like a thing that you have to make an event about or make it a big deal about a show. Oh my God, this show is making a class critique. Like, that's just baked in. I think a lot of it comes to also the national security law that still exists in Korea that happened during the re-regime, which is that you're still censored not even in a way, like, you can't talk about anything that makes socialism sound good, and critiques about the government are not allowed. So Koreans from very early on learned to create media and art that had to be more metaphorical or, like, more artistic in a way, so you danced around that subject, which then created a unique type of art. And then even though that law has been getting relaxed, that tradition has been maintained. So people do it for stylistic reasons. And it's similar to Japan, because they also had a censorship law where they couldn't talk about the damages of the nuclear bombs. So they had to make Godzilla movies and body horror to dance around that subject, which then made Japanese movies very interesting. So that's why, like, even before the quote-unquote Korean moment, right, Japanese movies, going back to what you were talking about with Battle Royale, they had their moment first, right, because they were doing all these interesting things, because they had to dance around these barriers that the U.S. put on them, right? And in the same way, Korea had to dance around these barriers where, even though it was technically Syngman Rhee that initiated that law, he was not only U.S.-backed, but it was 3 months after the U.S. put him in charge, and the U.S. military government was still in Korea when that law was enacted. So it's all very much still influenced by the U.S. So I think because of imperialism, you know, like when you're under imperialism, art has to get really creative.
That's absolutely true. And I noticed, it's interesting, there is an overlap with Iran in the same ways that you can't, there are kind of, you know, you can't say some things and you have to kind of dance around them. A lot of things for a while, like kids became kind of a vehicle for social critique and stuff like that. And kind of people push the boundaries. I mean, I think it's changed and I'm oversimplifying things, but like, yeah, a lot of cultures can't say things directly. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of create these elaborate frameworks to comment. And so like, we should probably wrap it up. It's been an hour and you have to go and take care of your dear child, but you can't be a deadbeat dad like our main character. But the piggy box too, like the piggy box standing over like this whole time, like money, every time somebody dies, all the money being like vacuumed in, not vacuumed, but basically like air, like pneumatically blown into this thing, like it was a TV show, like this perverse TV show. And it turns out, again, spoilers, sorry people, that it actually was a game show for like five rich people, rich, like white, pervy, and one Chinese guy.
Yeah.
One Chinese guy and like four vaguely like Euro-American dudes.
Yeah. You know?
Did they really have to make the guy gay? Is that really necessary? I guess, like, because it was like, oh, look at this horrible human being. He's also gay.
Yeah.
I was thinking that for a second. But his gayness wasn't really that big. But it was just more like he just wanted to like consume everything around him. So he like picked this guy. The whole organ, what's beautiful too, what I wanted to say earlier, the whole organ, secret organ harvesting subplot inside of all this was amazing. And also the cop stumbling upon the place and like sort of lurking in the site the whole time. And yeah, man, this was so well done. This guy, he made this for $21 million.
Mm.
$21 million.
I wanted to go back to the point we were talking about with the censorship and what you can't say, right? There's a line in there where I believe Ji-young asks Hebyok, which is better, right? Which of the two Koreas is better? Or something about like, do you regret coming down here because you thought South Korea was going to be better, right? And the way the show, just going off the show logic, you see how brutal South Korea is just from this game, right? If this was real, you see that brutality, then it's leading up to the moment where Hebyok should say, you know, no, it wasn't better, right? But she doesn't say anything. We just linger there. And then we go to the next scene. And this is still the remnants of that law. Like that character, to stay true to what that character would say in real life, couldn't answer honestly. So it's best, the closest he could get is just leave it there unanswered. Because even the director cannot escape this game where he could just have the character say what it wants, right? So there's like this meta-analysis to where he is, the director himself is confined by the remnants of like this right-wing fascist regime that came under U.S. occupation, and he's still constrained by those rules.
Sam, thank you for your time. This was a wonderful conversation. Tell us where to find your podcast. Tell the name again in case they missed it. Mm-hmm. The article is called Squid Game in the Long Shadow of American Empire on the Real News Network. I'll link to it in the show notes.
Find me on Twitter, LiberationistMA. That's my handle. You can find all the links for my podcast and how to support us and articles at southpawpod.com.
Thank you, King.
All right, thank you.
عندما تكسو القفار الظلال تسكن البيض والربا والرمال وهواك ليس يغفو الجمال هما في الروح شعر وخيال آه يا أمان أين لي ذكر الليالي الطوال من هوانا والحنين ذاك عهد مر كالطيف وزاد آه يا أمان أين جرح العود يا وقت الصباح والثغر الوطاح ذكر عهد لي تراءى وراء آه يا أمان يا وشفاه الورد والثغر الأوطان